I've got a question here that I'd like to start out, because as we start looking at South Dakota as a potential generator and a potential solution to national power requirements and power demand, obviously the first place to start is right next door. And so I wanted to ask Terry, with regard to the CapEx 2020, in your opinion, does the Minnesota, as a policy matter, and as we look at the CapEx 2020, does Minnesota embrace South Dakota wind as a part of their solution, or do they view South Dakota as a competitor?
I'm not sure I can answer on the policy aspect, but we will suggest transmission plans to the policymakers that don't discriminate against the Dakotas. The plan makes sense. The Public Utilities Commission will ultimately evaluate it. I certainly can't speak for them, but in the transmission planning arena, we're looking broad at the supplies very broadly.
Okay, and we had one other question provided to us on a piece of paper for Dale here. It's, could you please explain how the congestion calculations are made and how the pricing is set for the transmission customers? Sounds like a PhD thesis to me, but...
I wished I knew. Congestion basically is when you run up to a level where a transmission line is at its limit and you can't go over that limit. It's like running into a wall. You can't go through it. So you have to do something else. You got to go around it. And that's basically what we do. We call it a redispatch. If we run into a congestion where we have the most economical dispatch and then we have to do something else, it costs you more money to redispatch or use another set of generators that cost more than the ones you were going to use. And that cost is calculated through a very complicated mathematical formula. And it'll tell you what that's worth. Can hear you. And no, I won't start over. How is pricing set for the transmission customers? That is really beyond plan, but I can basically say that we have a schedule that recovers the cost of the transmission or the revenue requirements of each person. It's on currently on a zonal basis, and there's a whole tariff on that listed on our website if you'd like to read about it. I think it's 600 pages, something like that. Anyway, it is basically that each person recovers their cost of the transmission or revenue requirements, and MISO collects those and pays it to them. And those are published tariffs, and they're also published rates on our website.
Okay, let's move on to another question. We'll take one from the floor.
You're going to have to turn your mic on.
Jim Newcomb, developer. I wanted to ask Terry a question about 2020. One of the advantages of wind generators is we can put up a plant fairly quickly. And when I heard you say we're traveling very fast on these studies, and by the time the study is completed and the public process and construction is done, it's 7 or 8 years. And to me, that is not very fast. That is like... that if there's some way to cut the time in half and to increase the capacity about twice, I would say then we're getting up to speed on what needs to be done in this area. What do you need in order to make that happen?
Well, I can certainly understand that point of view, and I think a fair amount of frustration from those that want to develop wind. First of all, the plans need to be robust. I don't think anybody in the energy community wants to build the wrong plan or build something that where we use up a corridor that it turns out didn't need to be used or would better be served. Planning we can speed up to some degree, but it's the interdependency between the plans that takes some time. The public process takes some time also, and in Minnesota, working on the four projects that will be described, the Group 1 projects, I don't think the PUC or the Minnesota Department of Commerce could do anything to move those faster. They have been just great trying to move those along, and then you're faced with engineering, right-of-way acquisition, and finally construction, and construction being dependent, it's very hard to get some of these lines out of service if you're, say, overtaking an existing corridor. In my opinion, one of the things that could speed up the process is the more agreement there is on the facilities to be built, the faster the process will move. And you'll hear, I think, others talk about a philosophy they call build it and they will come, build the transmission and the generation will come. But in my opinion, that takes a lot of agreement. It takes interstate agreement, and it takes agreement on energy policy. And to me, that's where the greatest promise is. Get the policy issues worked out so that transmission isn't the forum to work them out. And then the other elements, there isn't a magic bullet, but we just need to work on making those move faster.
Another question that I think maybe Dale can answer for us. 45% cap factor in South Dakota versus 30% cap factor in New York. Does it include line losses?
No. But the line losses at like 800 kVDC are about 5%. So you could put that in the calculation. I think it'd get down into the fuzz.
Mr. Lindenberg, Bob alluded to the fact of leaving coal in the ground and tapping the wind power into hydropower. Currently, our dams in South Dakota are at all-time lows at the start of this past year compared to when they were built. We're producing 20% of the hydroelectric power that we have in the past. Can you talk a little bit about what you said about Denver and the 100 years worth of water by using wind for the electric power?
Well, the calculation is if you used a great deal of wind, to simplify this, if you used a great deal of wind, you'd use a lot less water because water is used in general thermal cooling for fossil plants. And you would potentially have some more water available, either for irrigation, for drinking water, for industrial purposes, or whatever. The probability that you would see more water in the Missouri is possible, because a good deal of Missouri River water is used for cooling along the system, and you might find some more. I think the biggest issue there is just rainfall. You could use, if you had a great deal of wind in this area, you could use it for its energy factor, and you could keep the reservoirs higher in balancing out the energy, although you'd still have to supply one way or another the firm power that was guaranteed by the Corps of Engineers and Western Area Power Administration to certain premium users. But we certainly are very interested in trying to balance out hydropower against wind power. The program that I work in at the Department of Energy is wind and hydropower. And we've been looking at that for a good deal of time. There are many policy issues to try and work out to make that work effectively. But in the future, with more wind, we may very well find that hydropower is something we can balance.
Hi, I don't actually have a question for the panel, but I'm Mike Bull. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Renewable Energy in Minnesota at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And there was a question earlier that I think Terry handled appropriately, but I wanted to address it myself, if I could, real quickly. The question was whether or not we see development of South Dakota wind as a competitor to development of Minnesota wind. And I can tell you, for my part, that no, that the development of South Dakota wind has definite benefits to Minnesota ratepayers. We definitely want to develop our own resources in Minnesota and retain as much of those benefits as we can within the state. But the need is great. As a result of Minnesota's renewable energy standard, the need is huge. And we're going to need a large blend of projects in order to meet those needs on the time frame that we've laid out in our statute. And so, no, we do definitely welcome the development of South Dakota wind, North Dakota wind, even Iowa. We'd even count Iowa.
All right, don't take our mic.
No.
You have any other questions? We have about 2 minutes.
Well, I was going to ask, I'd like to ask Bob to just touch on for a second. With all of the numbers that you presented and all of the attributes that the tribal lands offer, what do you see as the impediments to private investment on tribal lands? Or are you expecting that the tribes themselves will develop all of that resource from their own investment capital?
The principal impediment is the lack of the applicability of the production tax credit. There's a lot of people knocking on the doors to build projects on reservations, but the structure for the business has to be that the tax owner has to own the project for at least the first 10 years. And for tribes, business as usual is over. Tribes are no longer interested in simply being renters, leasing out resources low and then buying the product high. They'd like to be part of that continuum. And if the legislation that's proposed is the one of the perfect remedies in that regard, because it allows for joint ventures of tribes and outside capital to come in. Tribes don't have deep enough pockets to build very extremely large wind projects. The federal government doesn't have the deep pockets either. Billions of dollars have been authorized under the energy bills, but not a dime has been appropriated for build out. That's just not happening. So tribes need to be able to work with outside private capital, and they're welcoming partners, but they want to be full equity partners in the deal. And right now the 2 cent tax credit is denied, tribes are denied the use of it. They get it, they can't use it. And the problem is the utility that wants to buy the power assumes the project gets it. And the offer comes in 2 cents below what they would offer otherwise. So that tribal projects are penalized to the extent of tribal ownership because they can't use the tax credit. If they can share it with their partners, it brings outside capital and builds tribal capacity, not just wind turbines, but business capacity.
Thank you. I think we have one more question.
Let's introduce ourselves as we do it. I should have asked for that earlier.
Okay, I'm Randy Lindstrom with the Nebraska Public Power District. I had a question with respect to the EWIT study and the involvement of the MAP Regional Transmission Committee. As you are probably aware of, the MAP RTC is the planning authority for South Dakota, Nebraska, and also most of North Dakota and Iowa. And those states would most likely significantly contribute to this 20% goal. And I guess my question is why was the MAP RTC excluded from this joint process with the other planning authorities?
First off, I want to say we really want your input. We want to work with you on that. We're working with Dale's group, which is MISO, PJM, TVA, and SBP. So I might turn it off over to Dale, and he'll address why that group was put together as such.
First of all, participation in that study is voluntary. So if you volunteer, you participate. We've asked Western Area Power Basin. They've said they'd participate. Paul Malone said he'd participate for MPPD. MEC said they may participate. They may. And If you want to participate, you participate. I don't know why they weren't asked. We publicized it. We made it available. We've been presenting it. We just didn't send out invitations.